This is the Six Figure Home Studio Podcast, episode 17.
You're listening to the Six Figure Home Studio Podcast, the number one resource for running a profitable home recording studio. Now your hosts, Brian Hood and Chris Graham.
Welcome back to another episode of the Six Figure Home Studio Podcast. I am here with my podcast co-host, Chris Graham. How are you doing today, Chris?
I am fantastic. It's 60 degrees in Columbus, Ohio right now.
It's 72 right now in Nashville, which at the time of recording this, it's the day after Valentine's Day, and it shouldn't be this warm and sunny out.
You might say that 72 degrees is terrible podcasting weather in February for you, and it is for me. I should go outside soon.
How was your Valentine's Day, by the way? Did you do anything cool with the wife?
Yeah, I did the coolest thing that you can possibly do.
No, you didn't. I did, but you go first. I'll tell you what I did.
Well, trust me. I did the coolest thing with my wife that you can possibly do. My wife doesn't believe in Valentine's Day because she's awesome. We don't do Valentine's Day.
What the hell?
Yeah, we think it's cheap and creates this unhealthy expectation. It was a big issue for us when we first got married because we had different expectations about Valentine's Day. And I remember one time I was out touring. I was like a solo singer, songwriter, musician. And I decided to drive home from New York City on February the 13th to get home, but there was 9 inches of snow on the ground and I was going to have to drive through 9 inches of snow the whole way. But luckily, I had a Subaru. So I went for it and drove home to be with my wife on our first Valentine's Day, and she got really mad that I didn't get her anything.
Oh, whoa.
I risked my life. I was literally one of 5 cars from New York City to Columbus, Ohio, which is a good 8 hours with good weather.
Oh my God.
That I saw the whole time. It was insane.
That hurts for me. Well, I know that my girlfriend, her favorite day of the year is Valentine's Day.
Aww.
So I know how to go about this. There are no mismatched expectations. We went out to something called Dinner Time Stories last night, which is a projection mapping dinner. If you've ever seen concerts where they have like projections up behind the people and there's all sorts of crazy shit, that's called projection mapping.
Huh.
They had 15 projectors above the tables, and on the tables are projecting this story. And it's like this dude walking around, going through all these different nations to find all these different ingredients. And he's like building this meal on your plate. And then they bring out 6 courses of meals to you. And they're all different themes from different countries. It was amazing.
It sounds like to go on that date that you needed to have a 6-figure home studio to afford it.
I'm not going to talk about that shit, but it was a lot of fun and it was a cool experience. So we were definitely the youngest people there.
That's amazing.
Anyways, that was just the worst use of the time of the podcast possible. But you know what? There's some personal stories about it.
Yes. Yeah. Personal banter, personal banter, personal banter. Now down to business.
Yeah. You know the formula. Here we go. So today's episode, we were talking about some episode topic ideas. And we thought it might be interesting to do an episode about what we think are the stages of a typical recording career, or not even a typical, maybe an extraordinary recording career. What are the 5 stages look like? So we mapped out from both of our experiences what we think the 5 stages of a successful recording career are. And just to preface this, you know, this is not the end all be all list of the 5 stages you will guaranteed to be going through. Both Chris and I had some differences on what we thought the stages might be, so we'll probably talk about that throughout the episode. But we're going to give you 5 stages of a successful recording career starting now.
So the first stage in a successful recording career is pre-revenue. It's before you make any money. And for those of you guys that have heard Brian Hood's interview, I believe that was episode 3, Brian's pre-revenue story is insane. This idea that he got Pro Tools before he, you know, was the successful owner, producer, entrepreneur that he is. He got Pro Tools and he would stay awake for 30 hours. 40 hours learning to use Pro Tools. And then he'd fall asleep and then wake up and spend 40 more hours.
Yeah. It was like 120 something hours that first week of my pre-revenue career.
Yeah. And so on and so forth. Drive, pretty fascinating. So yeah, like this is an interesting part of everyone's career and it's important, you know, it's to just, you can't just show up and say, I will record you for money or I'll mix your record for money without having done something pre-revenue on that.
Yeah. This is like where you're starting to build your equity as a business owner. You're starting to put in the time, put in the effort, to put all the pieces into place so that you can make it to these other stages of your career. Because if you can't get past this stage, you're not a business.
Yeah. So I think one of the things I love about our podcast and some of the feedback we've gotten is that we just assume that you're after this, that you've already finished this. You sort of know how to do anything you would need to do professionally. You just haven't been able to get paid. So we debated on whether to even include this section.
I think it'll be helpful to people.
Yeah. It's important just to recognize not all of our podcast listeners actually have a business yet. It's their dream to do this. And this is the podcast to listen to do that.
So let's talk about the pre-revenue phase or the pre-revenue stage, whatever you want to call this. This is where you're just putting in your time. You're learning your craft. You have to be, ultimately, no matter what your goals are for your studio monetarily, you have to be good enough to get paid to do this. You have to be good enough. And if you can't put the time and effort in to learn the stuff you need to learn to hone your craft to the level you need to hone it to, it's going to be a long and difficult road if you can't get that into your head. You have to be, first and foremost, talented at what you do.
Absolutely.
And a lot of this you're going to learn throughout the other four stages of your career, but you have to have at least a decent enough foundation to get to where you can get paid. So it's about learning your craft, paying your dues, and you're going to have to be probably doing some amount of free work. Now, Chris, do you remember my five rules for doing free work?
Oh, I remember discussing them. I don't remember what they are offhand, though. Please elaborate.
So if you want my five rules for free work, you can go to homestudiorates.com. There's a rate sheet. And on that rate sheet, there are the five rules of doing free work. But from what I remember, I don't remember them all either. From what I remember, it was first of all, don't do big projects. If you're going to do free work, do small projects. So singles, maybe one or two songs, but don't do a full album. Don't do a multi-week project for free because that will just suck your soul away from you. And that's just someone taking advantage of you. So my whole philosophy behind free work is if you're going to do it, don't be too proud. If you're not good enough to get free work, you're definitely not good enough to get paid work. So if you can't get paid work, try to get free work. If you can't get free work, you're not good enough yet. So you're going to stay in the pre-revenue phase until you can get good enough to at least do free work.
Yeah. Or you might be too shy to put yourself out there that, hey, I can do a better job than the next guy. That part of being able to get people to pay you money to do a thing that you love is you have to be arrogant enough to say, I'm better than the next guy.
Not even arrogant enough. You just have to be willing to fail. It doesn't require arrogance. It requires that you put yourself out there in order to fail and not be too afraid of failure to be in a position to succeed. So with free work, go download the rate sheet, homestudiorates.com. Look up the five rules of free work, because once you get past that, you will need to know what sort of rates to charge. I think that's going to be super helpful for you. But you're also in this phase, when you're doing this free work, you're building relationships with those people that you're working with. And that is a super important part of getting out of this pre-revenue phase, is to build relationships with people that are eventually going to pay you down the road.
Absolutely. Well, let me jump back into one of these issues in pre-revenue. And for you guys that already are making money, I promise we'll be quick and move on to the other more exciting ones of this. But I think it's important to point out this idea of paying your dues. I don't totally agree with some of the baggage that comes with that term.
What do you mean?
Well, the world that existed 20, 30 years ago, you couldn't really get a job doing anything without paying your dues.
This is true.
I like to say, there's only been a few times in human history when children grew up in their world, not in their parents' world. So I'm 35. My mom is in her 60s. And I don't live in my mom's world. My mom lives in my world. So much has changed, and technology is such an enormous part of our world that it's uncomfortable for people that are in an older generation to exist in this world of podcasts and digital advertising and email and reviews. There's just so much that's different. So paying your dues usually meant going to somebody older and more experienced and getting the thumbs up from them.
Yeah, I agree that it has changed. It's now more, can you work smarter than some of the older generation that are maybe struggling a little bit because they haven't adapted? And not to be negative on anyone that is older that hasn't adapted yet, but there is just a new reality of what it takes to be successful. And a lot of people refuse to make the changes necessary. And if you can be the one that's willing to put in the work, and I still think it's part of paying your dues. Paying your dues isn't about putting time in, to me. It's about learning the things you need to know in order to be successful. And so for me, my pre-revenue stage, that lasted a month. from the day I bought my gear to my first paid project was a month or less. So it wasn't like it was this long drawn out process where I just was trying to get free work. I actually never did free work in my pre-revenue phase. I had already done a lot of work to build my reputation. So I was a little different. I had my band's back to kind of jump off of. So it can be a little different for everybody. If you don't have any prior relationships, you may need to do free work. You may have to take a little longer in the pre-revenue phase. But when we get out of that, then we get into stage two. And that is what we call yes mode.
So yes mode is an interesting one. Yes mode is the opposite of stage three that we'll get to momentarily, which is niching down. Yes mode is exactly what it sounds like. You have skills. You will accept money to use those skills in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. So this is all about taking on whatever projects you can get. At this stage in your career, you may not have any clue about what niche you're in. You may not be working with any specific type of genre or artist. You're just taking whatever you can get. And the reason that is so important is because you are discovering where your passions lie. You're discovering where your talents really are, and you're discovering where you excel and what you want to do. And until you've experienced a lot of different things, it's going to be hard to say, hey, I want to do this for the next 5 to 10 years, or hey, I want to do this for the rest of my life, or hey, I want to do this for at least the next year or two. It's very difficult to do that if you haven't experienced a lot of different areas.
Yeah. And with that, this is going to be hilarious to share. This is a really hillbilly illustration and was my business plan all along. You know, when you go fishing, what you do is you take a bunch of poles and you put them out in the water and you wait and you see which one of those poles is getting the most bites. And then you throw away all the other fishing poles.
I hate that so much.
So hillbilly.
I get it though.
That was my strategy when I started in audio, was I'm going to say yes to everything.
And see what sticks.
Yeah, I'm going to see what sticks. So I'm going to try to do some mixing. I'm going to try to do some recording. I'm going to try to do some producing. I'm going to try to do some writing with some clients. I'm going to try to become this ultimate studio musician hiring guy of like, I'll hook you up with the right studio musicians and then I'll oversee the session and obviously mastering. And my goal there was I'll put all these fishing poles out in the water and I'll see which one gets the most bites and which one gets the best fish. And for me, that was hands down mastering. That ended up being in my blood. And I would have never known that had I not experimented with a lot of other audio tasks.
And I see this a lot in just young entrepreneurs, people in their early 20s that have that entrepreneur spirit. When you're young, when you're inexperienced and you just don't know what you want for the rest of your life or for where you are in your life, trying many different areas of business is a great way to kind of figure out where your passions lie and where your skills and abilities lie and where you want to go from there. And until you've experienced a bunch of different things in business, it's hard to know where you should put your time and effort and focus. And it's the same in the recording world. If you're trying to do audio for a living, say yes to a lot of different things. And eventually that one thing or those one or two things will start to stand out to you. As Chris called it, the fishing poles or the lures that get bit. What was the saying?
I put a bunch of fishing poles out, waited to see which one was getting bites.
Bites. Yeah, there you go.
You know, which one was bringing in the best fish. And so I would encourage you, you know, if you're like, I love audio, I want to do something in a recording studio, say yes to voiceover work. Say yes to video game, you know, audio design. Say yes to everything, whatever you can think of. Say yes to Foley artists. You should go, you know, attend a Foley session and see if maybe that's for you. You should say yes to doing audio for a movie.
And while you're doing this, this is where you're starting to build your portfolio, because you're hopefully getting paid for these projects. You're saying yes to pretty much, you have money, I'll do your job. I'll do your whatever mixing or mastering or editing or recording that you have if you're paying me. And at that point, you're building your portfolio and you're hopefully discovering in some way, shape, or form what your niche is. That is the goal of stage two, the yes mode, is to discover what your niche is. And that is when we move into stage three, that is niching down. That is when you have discovered your niche and you start to take advantage of that.
Yeah, that's amazing. So the big thing to keep in mind there is I think it's really easy to get too focused on niching down. If you niche down too soon, that's really, really, really dangerous and bad.
Yeah, and we got a lot of feedback after our niching down episode of people that were like in this point in their career, they're in the yes mode phase and they have no direction of where they want to go yet. And so they had this feeling like we were telling them, you have to niche down, you have to niche down, you have to niche down. Not everyone is at the place for that to happen yet. And if you are at the place where you feel like you have no idea where to go, you're still in phase two or stage two, the yes mode stage. And you need to just focus on taking whatever you can in right now until you discover where it is that you need to move next.
Yeah. So I think the big thing there is if you're trying to invent a way to niche down, there's some, you know, value, I think, in kind of creatively considering some other options. But ultimately, your gut should be really clear with you about where you want to niche down. If it lights your brain up to edit drums for jazz records, and that's like the crazy, most fun thing you've ever done, it's worth considering. You know, there's a trap to fall in here too of, you know, you see a lot in our culture here in America where people will say, I want to do this. Oh, this is so cool. I want to do this for a living. And they don't realize that, like, hey, something being cool one time, cool 40 hours a week for 30 years does not make. And
yeah, seriously, I see a lot of people that don't understand that when you start doing this full time, it is a career. It is a job sometimes. And some days you don't want to do it and you have to be okay with that. So you're not always going to have this burning passion every single day to wake up and do what you're doing. But when you contrast that against a career that you actually hate to begin with, it is so much better.
Yeah.
Even the worst days in the studio are better than the best days at some corporate job that you loathe.
Yeah. One of the reasons I got into mastering in the first place was I noticed that the thing that I've always enjoyed more than anything else is making anything sound slightly better. Whether that's working on an electric guitar, whether that's working on an electric guitar amp, whether that was working on an acoustic guitar and, you know, putting fancy bridge pins in or something like that. If it sounded better once I was done fiddling with it, that was the most fun thing in the world.
Which is why mastering was a good draw to you. You didn't care about the genre. You're just like, I want this to sound a little bit better.
Yeah. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind is that when you niche down, I think there's this fantasy that many young people have of, I'm going to go into audio and I'll only work on great songs with great bands for the rest of my life. I don't think anyone has loved every single band they've worked with in any service part of the audio industry. So you have to love it more than just loving to work with cool bands or cool artists. And thank God I do. If it sounds better, if I don't like a song, but it sounds better when I'm done with it, that's super fun. And I don't even mind that I don't like the song. It's so fun to make something sound better. So with niching down, one of the most important things to keep in mind is this 80-20 rule. We've talked about it before.
Pareto's principle.
Yeah, Pareto's principle. Basically, it states that 80% of your revenue is probably coming from 20% of the things that you do. If that's the case, it's time to niche down. If that's not the case, you're probably not quite ready to niche down. The other thing to keep in mind here is that 80% of your joy probably comes from 20% of the things that you do. If you're really lucky and those things line up, then boy, it's time to niche down. It's time to go. But again, there's another component to this. It might not be 80% of your revenue come from 20% of your sources, but it might mean that your hourly is significantly higher doing one type of work than it is another type of work. And that's another important thing to pay attention to where, you know, if you are editing drums for different producers and you're mixing records for different producers and you're recording bands and you're also composing video game scores, you do the math and it turns out that you happen to be amazing at editing drums and you're actually making $5 more per hour on average when you do that, you need to consider that. That might be your niche. And it should be really evident from a financial perspective that you should niche down.
My yes mode stage lasted about a year. You know, my first year in business, I was just taking on any sort of project, jazz, rock, acoustic, pop, and then obviously hardcore and metalcore bands because that was what I was known for in my previous band. And that was some of the bands that were in my area. So I was all over the place as far as genres and I was saying yes to anything that had money. But by the end of the first year, I had basically just slowly started just only doing hardcore and metalcore bands because that was the stuff that was coming to me constantly. It's not like I just decided out of thin air that I'm going to niche down in the heavy music world and that's the only thing I'm ever going to do. It's not like I did that. It was just, it naturally grew and basically the niche chose me. That's how it came about. I just started doing more and more of those bands and naturally over time, my messaging, my positioning, all of the gear I had, everything about what I did catered to heavy music. So from year two until now, that is the niche I've been in. And from 2010, which was year two for me, that is when my income has just started to grow and grow and grow. So once you start to niche down, and you've either chosen your niche or your niche has chosen you, this is where your business will start to grow. And that's how it was for me. I believe that's how it was for Chris, but that was when my income started to go up and I really gained traction in my studio.
Yeah. So for me, it was a little bit different. There's basically two ways that you can begin to niche down. One of them is what Brian just described, where you are taking on a bunch of different types of projects, and rather than deciding on your niche, you decide what your niche is not. So let's say you're working with acoustic, jazz, pop, metalcore, you know, et cetera, and you decide, you know what? I'm not loving pop. The projects don't go well. I don't have great pop sensibilities or whatever. So I'm not going to take pop projects anymore. You haven't niched down, but you're closer to your niche. You've taken a step in that direction.
Yeah, that's one of the things we talk about, the 80-20 principle is, you know, there's also 80% of your problems can come from 20% of the artists you work with. So if there's just one genre and you're just saying, hey, hip hop artists are the worst in the world to work with, and they bring in about 20% of my income, but it's about 80% of my problems, I should probably just not do that kind of music anymore. And I could put my time and effort and focus on these other genres that are paying me money and aren't giving me the grief and strife and negativity in my life and heartache and headache that hip hop or rap or whatever this other genre is giving me right now. So that's one thing to consider when you're in the niching down stage is, what can I cut out of my services or my genres?
Yeah, for sure. The other way you can niche down, and this is much scarier, and what's what I did, but it's probably not what I'd recommend to anybody else, was I came to a really strong, very convicted conclusion, this epiphany that mastering is what I need to be doing. This is where I'm supposed to be. And a lot of that was, I had an idea for the before and after player that's on my website, where you select a genre and then you press play and you can switch back and forth between mastered and unmastered in real time on a website. When I came up with that idea, nobody on earth had anything like that. It was the very first of its kind. And so what I did was I did a little bit more intense thing where I just said mastering only. And there was a dip. I made a little bit less for a couple months until I got things rocking and rolling. And that dip, because I had also noticed, one, I love mastering. Two, I'm getting paid really well when I do it. Three, the projects are the most consistent. I'm consistently getting projects. And four, if I didn't already say this, I freaking loved it. It was wonderful. So I took a dip before I niched down so that I could focus on mastering, no pun intended, one thing.
Now, did you take a dip before niching down or after niching down? Because it sounded like me, you took a dip after niching down. You chose mastering and then you took that dip.
Yeah, I chose mastering and then I took that dip.
So your income declined for a while. And then after that, I assume it just rose and rose and rose?
Yeah, rose and rose. So yeah, it took a dip. That ended up being the best year I'd ever had by a couple thousand. And then it wasn't until a little bit later on when I got into this next stage, maximization, when the next year doubled. It was twice what anything I'd ever made before.
And I don't want to move there quite yet, because I want to talk about this stage, stage three. I feel like a lot of people are in this stage or stuck in the stage or can't get past this stage. And so what happens if you do choose a niche or a niche chooses you and you focus on that and your income doesn't do what it did for both you and I, where it started to go up and up? What happens if your income just stays level or starts to decline month to month or year to year in your niche? What do you do then?
Well, if it stays level and you're happier.
Call that a win, yeah.
I call that a huge win. You know, ultimately, I saw this really depressing. So it's February 15th for us right now. We're recording the podcast yesterday, obviously, Valentine's Day. And there was this hilarious music producers meme that came out. And it was, you know, what everyone does on the left on Valentine's Day. And it was two people on a date. And what I do on Valentine's Day. And then it was a guy sitting in front of a Pro Tools rig mixing.
So accurate, though.
Oh, man.
For 6 years of my life, that's how I spent six Valentine's days in a row.
Exactly. So if you niche down and don't make any more money, but you're happier and healthier, that's a win.
What did that have to do with Valentine's Day and being sad on Pro Tools?
Well, I mean, that guy hasn't niched down
okay.
yet.
Okay. When you niche down, you'll find love.
Yeah. When you niche down, you'll find love and have time for those you love.
No. I get it. But I think it is important to say, like, you know, define what success is to you. And that's beyond the scope of what you can do in one episode here, because everyone's level of success is different. Part of it's happiness, part of it's income. I know we're the Six Figure Home Studio, but I base what I consider success on much more than financial. You know, it's, to me, financial is secondary to me doing what I want to do for my life. All right, so let's move into stage four here. That is the maximization phase. And this is where both you and I unanimously agreed that more 80-20. This is where you do even more 80-20 on your business.
Yeah.
And we have three specific things in the maximization phase to really start ramping up. So maybe if you have niched down, maybe you are level on your income, maybe stage four, maybe this is how you get your income up year to year to year. Maybe this is how you double your income next year or even this year. And there are three specific steps that we talk about in the maximization phase. Chris, you want to take these?
Yeah. So these are straight out of the Six Figure Home Studio Bible, AKA the 4-Hour Work Week.
Yeah.
And
well, let's give the three. We have elimination, automation, and then delegations in that order. And I did it backwards. I did delegation, automation, then elimination, I think, in my own business. But let's talk about it in this order and why we like it in this order. Elimination, automation, delegation.
So let me first just sort of point out to those listening, based on the feedback we've gotten from our listeners and where most people tend to be, this is the good part of the podcast. This is the good part of this episode where we get down to the nitty gritty that is rarely understood and is the only reason I have any level of success.
Yeah, then this is where it starts getting really fun. If you can make it to this stage, this, in my opinion, is the most fun in business that you can, when you get to this sort of, actually, I'll say the next stage is actually the most fun, but this is the first time you can really start to have fun in a business. You know, the rest of this, it's a lot of fun as a audio engineer, as a mixing engineer, as a mastering engineer, as a creative side. But stage four to me is the first time you really have fun as a business owner, as an entrepreneur.
Yeah. You get to open it up, man. You get to put the pedal to the metal and feel the wind in your hair. And this is when growth starts to happen fast.
If you do it right.
It was mind-blowing for me when I started to experience this. And for me, I've mentioned this in previous episodes, this started to happen to me when my wife was pregnant with our first kid. And once he was born, it was like a million miles an hour.
Game on.
Game on. You know, I saw that little boy's face and there was just this like instantaneous rewiring of my brain. And it was like, I must provide. And it was amazing.
So let's bring this back to elimination, the first part of the maximization phase. Elimination. What do you mean by elimination?
So elimination is tough for us audio engineers. Elimination is recognizing what things we do are completely unnecessary and a complete waste of our time. And there are a lot of examples of that. I was talking to a mix engineer this morning, and he was talking about how he has gotten so dialed in on the way that he mixes that he doesn't spend like an hour on each track experimenting with different compressors. He knows this is my go-to. This is my sound. This is what I use. I'm not going to use any compressors except this compressor from here on out, or these two or these three.
And that worked for some people and not for others. So I understand some people want to experiment. They want to get creative. So I understand that. But at the same time, part of elimination is understanding what works and what doesn't. And the stuff that doesn't work for you, the stuff you know is a waste of time, getting rid of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Recognizing that if a perfect example would be, I have lots of friends who have been in audio for a long time. A lot of them started in analog and had a big giant console, and it was super expensive and super flighty and would break, and they'd need to, you know, pull channels and solder. You know, you basically used to know how to solder to be an audio engineer years ago. And one of the ways that they did the elimination thing was they switched to digital.
And that eliminated all of the maintenance, all of the power needs for that, you know, the electricity usage for that and the heat in the room, depending on the size of the console they use. But that eliminates a lot of headaches, not even to mention recall on sessions.
That's a perfect example of elimination, is that when an audio engineer says, you know, I would rather be more productive and accept the limitations that digital gave, you know, at the time. I don't believe it. There are nearly as many limitations now as there were, say, 15, 20 years ago, but accepting those drawbacks in order to get something better in return. So spotting these things, these opportunities for elimination, where you can be a minimalist, where you can do a few things well, where you can have a few tools that you reach for that allows you to speed up and to become more efficient and to not drudge through the weeds trying to come up with that last 1/100th of a percent improvement that nobody will ever hear, that could have been better spent on pre-production.
A 0.5 dB difference in anything has never sold an extra record, ever. I'll say another issue or another way to eliminate is, you know, we talked about eliminating specific genres, you know, that you work with, but I think sometimes eliminating services. So when Chris niched down, he niched down by cutting out every other service besides mastering. But, you know, when I hit the maximization phase of my own business, I had already niched down. I was already in the heavy music niche. And when I applied even more 80-20 principle to my business, I had ran the numbers for the year, 2014, and I realized 70% of my income came from mixing, and I spent 20 to 30% of my time doing that, as opposed to tracking and editing and lodging bands, where I spent 70% of my time, 80% of my time doing that, and I made 30% of my income doing that. So when I looked at that...
And let me pause you there. It's important to point out, that was you. That's not going to be everybody.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's not going to be everybody, but everyone's going to experience something like that, where your time and your income are not always directly in the same thing. When you hit this maximization phase, it's hard to do that sort of self-assessment. It's hard to look at when you're working every single day, putting in a lot of time, a lot of hours. Until you hit this phase of elimination, automation, delegation, you're never going to have enough time in the day to do anything you want to do on your business. You're just going to be working in your business every single day. And part of it is making time, no matter what, to make these sort of assessments on your business and then determining what it is you need to cut out. And so, what is it you need to cut out, so eliminate? Or what is it you need to automate so you can make it more efficient? Or what do you need to delegate? These three things, until you can take the appropriate amount of time and step back and look at your business and really assess it from a number standpoint and a quality of life standpoint, it's going to be really difficult to get through this phase into the final phase of a successful recording career, which we're going to talk about in a second. And for me, that was assessing that tracking, editing, lodging was no longer a viable thing in my business. I wanted to focus on mixing and mastering exclusively, and I cut out a significant portion of revenue. It was about $40,000 a year. It wasn't an insignificant amount of money, but it freed up a lot of time in my business to put towards other areas of my business, automation, delegation, and pivoting, which we're going to talk about in a second.
Have you ever actually sat down and thought about where your next client will come from? Most freelancers don't, because most freelancers' number one strategy for getting new clients is something called hope marketing. And if that sounds like you, you're not alone. Most freelancers think that just by putting out great work, clients will come banging down your door to hire you. Now, while you obviously do need to be good at what you do, we both know that this strategy does not work. Otherwise, your calendar would be 100% booked solid with amazing projects from your ideal clients. So to help you with this fight against hopium addiction, I'm excited to announce that our flagship coaching program, Clients by Design, has finally opened up applications again. This transformational coaching journey is not a one-size-fits-all. It's tailor-made just for you. We'll do a deep dive into your business to see what's missing, and we'll lay out a step-by-step roadmap to guide you over the next 6 to 8 months. And here's the best part. We don't just give you the plan and send you on your way. We give you personal one-on-one help so you never get stuck. And we make sure you actually follow through with something called our absolute accountability system. So if you're ready to stop relying on hope marketing and ready to start building your own client acquisition machine so you can get a steady flow of clients, then it's time to step up and apply for Clients by Design and see if you're a good fit. Just go to sixfigurecreative.com/coach. And I'll be the first to say that this program is not for everyone. So far, we've only accepted about 25% of those who apply. So if you want to find out if you're a good fit, just go to sixfigurecreative.com/coach and fill out the application. Now here's our show.
Yeah. So one of the important things to keep in mind there too is a word called stewardship. Stewardship is this idea that we have been given a gift and we have to use that gift as best we can. And so for Brian, giving up $40,000 a year in tracking revenue and producing revenue sucked. I'm sure it hurt. I'm sure it was uncomfortable and painful, but you had been given a gift, and that was you were amazing at mixing and really efficient at it. To be a good steward of the gifts that you were given, you had to say no to some things.
Yeah, and it didn't hurt that I just despised tracking and editing. It didn't hurt at all. Whenever your income and your enjoyment are tied to the same thing, that is a huge thing.
So the last piece with elimination is elimination doesn't just mean eliminating inefficient things. It also means eliminating things that make you miserable, that don't give you life, and that slow you down. So if you're in a position where you drink a 2 liter of Mountain Dew every day, that's something you might want to eliminate. It might be messing you up. If it's something where you go to bed at 5 in the morning because you were up playing World of Warcraft every night, that might be something you want to eliminate. In order to maximize your day, your energy, your IQ, your creativity, you name it, there are things you have to cut out from your life sometimes. And it's tough, man. There's no easy way to say, you know what? For me, it's unhealthy to read the news on my iPhone.
So let's just say we're in the maximization phase. where we'll say where our income's pretty good at this point. It should already be pretty good at this point. You've started to eliminate the things in your business you need to eliminate. And now we're getting to automation. We're automating some things in our business that we need to automate. Let's talk about, and I can actually pull one example out immediately. And that was when Chris Graham started ramping up his Google advertising dollar spend. So he was getting more work than he could possibly manage to get, but he was wasting so much time in his business, importing tracks, labeling tracks, doing fade outs, bouncing the tracks down, emailing to the band. All of these things were adding up, because when you do, you're working with 5 to 10 clients per day. Just the client management side of things, just the file management side of things, all these non-creative tasks in his business were a huge waste of time to him. So what did he do? He automated all of that. If you want to go back to Chris's episode number 2, where we interview him, he goes into a lot more detail about how he did that. But go ahead and talk about a little bit behind the automation mindset behind this, not so much the specifics of it.
Yeah. So for me, the big thing you need to keep in mind is once you've niched down and you are doing one thing and doing it exceedingly well, there's a lot of repetition, you know, in mastering. There's a lot of loading files into your mastering software. There's a lot of downloading files and there's a lot of uploading files. When you do something repetitively that's inefficient, you're wasting a little bit of time every time you do that thing again.
It's like 30 seconds a track for every single track that you work with. And you work with thousands of tracks, so it adds up to a lot of time. And you can't eliminate this because these are all necessary steps in what you do. But then we get to the automation.
Yeah. So automation is amazing. One of my heroes is Henry Ford. I'm sure this is like the 15th time I've mentioned him.
Yes, it is.
But he has this great quote where he said, anytime that you do something inefficiently, you will pay a tax in either time, money, or energy. And that's intense. So for me, to take that extra time to manually upload files through YouSendIt.com back in the day and then wait for them to upload and then come back downstairs at night and make sure that the emails were being sent to the proper people was super inefficient. And it cost me not only a lot of time every day, but I couldn't be done for the day until way after I had gone home and eaten dinner, because I needed to come back and make sure that all the files, now that they were uploaded, could go to the right spot.
So it was a time suck and it was a focus suck, because you're focused on, did this happen correctly? And you can't just cut your mind off from work once you go home.
Yep. And what would happen with that is I'd come home, I would never completely turn off, and I would be exhausted all through the evening waiting for this to be done so I could finally take a deep breath at, say, 9:30 at night. And as a result, I wasn't well rested, so I was stupider the next day.
Well, also, that's not a word, but that's cool.
I know. I was trying to make a joke. It made me dumb and dumber the next morning. So the rest, being able to turn off and recover, like you've been mentioning on previous episodes, super important. So a lot of times this automation isn't even just about, you know, making more per hour, as it is like have enough time to recover and be healthy.
Yeah, there's multiple goals with all of this stuff. Sometimes it's getting time back. Sometimes it's making more money per hour. Sometimes it's just making your life more enjoyable.
Yeah. When I started automating the different administrative parts of my business so that I could come right in and get right to the creative part, right to the mastering, the part that I loved.
Yeah.
One of the things that surprised me was I found myself calling my clients much more often. I found myself much more social and much more chatty with clients than I had before, because I had the time to do it. And what happened was I began to enjoy my business considerably more, and people started hiring me because I was like the quote unquote nice mastering engineer. It was a novelty. There's no such thing as a nice mastering engineer.
I'll agree with that.
And so it was amazing that the automation freed me up to focus on relationships, which grew my business, in addition to the fact that I was way, way healthier and I was smiling when I would come home each day.
And I want to point out why this is after elimination. And that is because automating a task that should have been eliminated is pointless.
Yep.
That's why I think you should be eliminating everything you can that is not central to your whatever you want to focus on or what is important to you before you start the automation phase.
And the funny thing there is I'm sure some people are like, well, yeah, only an idiot would automate something he should have eliminated. I would struggle to estimate the number of times I've done that. I've automated something I should have eliminated over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Either because I'm a moron or because that's just the way it is. I'm not really sure.
No, I've done it too, so it's fine. All right, so then we get to, you know, we've done elimination. We've eliminated all the shit that we need to get rid of. We've automated the things, or at least started to automate a lot of the things that are repetitive, time consuming. But then there's going to be tasks like in my world with mixing and mastering, where when I'm doing my session prep, you can't automate that. You can't eliminate that, but you can delegate that. So in my experience, what I've done is I just build a step-by-step checklist out, something super easy to follow. I have a video in, with it as well, that shows every single step and what I need my mix prep assistant to do. And then I can just pass the checklist and instructional video off to him. Every single time I get files, I send it to my mix prep assistant. He knows exactly how I want everything set up from point A to point Z. And then all I have to do is open the session up and I start mixing. It is the most magical, beautiful thing you could have ever experienced. If you've never experienced this before, you need to do this ASAP.
It's amazing.
It's amazing, yeah. And I pay him for it. So that's the reason this is last. I have to pay them for us for his time. But it saves me so much time. It is more than worth it.
Yeah. The second part of delegation, and we've talked about this before on previous episodes, is delegating to your customers. A lot of people in this business will accept files from customers in any way, shape, or form. You can bring a flash drive by. You can bring a hard drive by. You can do Google Drive. You can do WeTransfer. You send it, Dropbox, etc. One of the things you can do to save yourself time is to get all your files from the same spot. And just to say, and this is how my website is, if you want mastering, you have to either upload it through my webpage or you have to share a Dropbox link on a specific part of the page as well. So all of my files only come in through one spot. So I don't have to like, oh crap, I'm missing the second mix for the third song. Was that Dropbox? Oh no, it was Google Drive. Oh shoot, no, that was the guy with the same name as him.
And Chris has kind of tied in automation and delegation into one big package here on his site. If you go to Chris's site, and if you're looking for mastering services, go to chrisgrahammastering.com and hire Chris out. And you can experience this for yourself. But you go to his site, you start to fill out his form, and depending on what options you pick, all of this nicely automated, logic-based form system starts to spread itself out as you start to fill things out. So depending on which DAW you use or depending on which sort of files or whatever, different options are going to come up. That is all automation. And then he also delegates some tasks to you. As the person spending money, he has basically outsourced certain tasks to you. And one of those being labeling the final master track names. Because that was a huge issue, is he doesn't know what the song titles are because the file names are a lot of times just working titles. They're not the final mastered names. So he needs to have that stuff. So why do this email back and forth? Why hire an assistant when you can just outsource it to the person who knows the stuff immediately? And that is you, the person hiring Chris Graham for mastering services.
Yeah, another example of that is one of the systems we recently integrated was asking people to trim their masters before they send them to me. I would occasionally, pretty often, get a master that would be like, oh, there's 10 seconds of hum at the beginning of this song, and there's 11 seconds of hum at the end. Well, that's silly. So there's a question on my upload form that just says, hey, would you please trim your masters? And then you can either select, yes, I did, or no, I can't. And that has helped a lot because a lot of the projects that come in are now not like, I'm not like trying to sequence it and then I'm moving all these things around and it's all this extra, why did they do that? Did they want the silence there? Or did they want the count in at the beginning of the song? Or did they want the banter after the last drum hit? Like, so all those questions are going back and forth. You can delegate to your customers to ask them to fill out a form and check, yes, I did this. No, I did not do that, etc.
Also with delegation, it's not just stuff in the studio, but stuff on your business. And this is where you start talking about email stuff. You're running your CRM. CRM, by the way, is part of automation in my experience. You're automating a lot of the reminder tasks, the management of data, all that stuff. But having an assistant, I have an assistant that does my email management, runs my CRM for me, will send invoices out, you know, collects payments, all that stuff for me, because that is what I consider non-creative tasks. Chris Graham is, I believe, in the process of hiring an assistant. Can we talk about that here?
Yeah, sure. If you guys go to chrisgrahammastering.com/apply, I'm looking for an administrative assistant.
Yeah, and this is all non-creative tasks doing, you know, administrative work.
No audio yet. So yeah, the big thing that I'm looking for help with is someone to help me with email, social media, research, etc. So I put that out, let's see, I think it was February 13th, had a bunch of applicants. I'm going to keep accepting applicants till I find the perfect person, and then I'll shut that particular page down.
So it could be down before this episode even goes live.
It's possible. But yeah, so this is something I'm not great at, hiring and delegating, and it's something that I need to grow in. And the time has come for, you know, I have, you know, other guys that work for me that I've delegated stuff out to, but I need a specific admin to help us manage, plan social media campaigns, et cetera, answer emails so that the emails can get answered faster than I could possibly do it myself. So yeah, I mean, this is something, the thing I love about doing this podcast is that I'm not some like guru at business stuff. This is a journey, and I believe it will always be a journey for me. And it's been a fun way to preach at myself that, hey, get off your butt and do some of these things.
I mean, in the grand scheme of business world, we are like peons compared to what's out there. Like, we are such small minnows in this giant business ocean. So there's in no way have we mastered any of this or all of this. We've mastered maybe tiny little bits and pieces of it. But I would say I really haven't mastered any of what we've talked about so far. Not elimination, not automation, not delegation. I've implemented bits and pieces of this, but I'm not perfect at any of this by any measuring stick. So elimination, automation, delegation, those are the big core parts of maximizing your business. And a lot of that comes down to, hey, you can't do everything as a business owner. You can't do every single thing in your business. You need to focus on what your core talents are and let other people handle that. And it's hard to get to this point until you have the revenue to support additional hires. And that's why this is stage four. So it's one of those things that, you know, you can focus on elimination at any point. You can focus on automation at really any point. And there's a lot of great tools out there to help with automation, but delegation is a little more difficult and save for more advanced people. Probably at least, you know, before you start hiring out specific tasks, probably at least 30 to 40K a year is what you're going to need. Maybe even a little less than that on certain tiny projects. But to have an assistant,
I would agree.
50, 60, 70K a year is in the US dollars, at least in our area, unless you want to hire someone in a lower income country like the Philippines. You know, you can hire someone out there at a very affordable rate.
Well, but at the same time, there is a huge opportunity. That's one of the reasons I'm talking about hiring an assistant on this show, is that there's a huge opportunity to hire part-time people, which is what I'm looking to do. I'm looking to hire a part-time assistant. Part-time remote assistant. And the beauty of that is
which is what Sean is to me.
Yeah. There's a huge number of people that are looking for that type of work. So it's amazing. You know, for me and my wife, we have three kids. We're homeschoolers. We're, you know, we drank as much of that Kool-Aid as you possibly can. We love it. But for other homeschool parents, there's a huge opportunity for them as a part-time admin that's remote. That's like the perfect job.
Yeah, so they can work from home, be with their kids. Yeah, that's the benefit of having this sort of position available. And so if you are at that level and where you're ready to hire an assistant, especially an administrative assistant, somebody to handle some of the business admin crap that's weighing you down, you're above 50, 60, 70,000 a year in income at your studio, start looking at people that have that sort of position. They're a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home parent of some sort, and they want to stay with their kids. They want to work remotely from home. They don't have to go into an office. You can get them at a very reasonable rate. Even someone that's very highly educated, they would take a massive pay cut of what they could get at a corporate job where the commute and all that bullshit's associated with it. They'll take a massive pay cut just because they'd rather work from home with their kids and not have to leave to an office every day. So I'm going to give a couple of websites real quick. For this sort of thing, there's a site called hiremymom.com. that is worth checking out if you're looking to hire, you know, stay-at-home mom. There is a site called Belay, B-E-L-A-Y, if you want to spend a lot more money on an assistant where they handle everything for you. And when we go back to automation, there's also a site called Zapier, Zapier.com. All of these will be in the show notes, sixfigurehomestudio.com/17, just the number 17.
Zapier is amazing.
Yeah, Zapier is awesome. It'll tie a bunch of software together to make your automation dreams come true.
I am just maybe their biggest fan. I love them. Zapier is, for you nerds out there, it is an API for APIs. And essentially what it lets you do is make different pieces of online software talk to each other. And you can make pieces of software that live on your computer talk to each other as well.
Think about every piece of software speaking its own unique language. They cannot communicate with each other. Zapier is simply the translator for all of this different software.
Yeah, you could basically say, hey, every time I get an email where the subject line says blink, I want you to blink the lights on in my house.
Yeah, you can literally do that.
You can literally do that. Or you can say, hey, every time someone signs up on my WordPress site, create a new account in HubSpot.
But let's move on to the final stage of a successful recording career. And this is kind of not part of the recording career. I guess it's kind of moving out of it. we call the stage the pivot stage. This is the pivot stage. So this is where you're moving on to something else, whether it's related to studio or not. And we have some examples. We're going to tell you examples of what we mean. First of all, what is the pivot phase or the pivot stage of a recording career? What do we mean by this stage?
Pivot is when you have gotten so good at your niche that you have room to do something else.
Or just so good at your business that you got room to do something else. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, in the business or in the studio world. This could be something completely different that your studio has enabled you to do. And so we have some examples here of things. And the first example and most obvious to me is when you get to stage five here, you could start a second business. I've seen this from many, many people. I've done it myself. And we have examples of plenty of people that have done this. But that is, you have a really nice home studio business humming along. You have consistent income coming in. And that enables you to do things that you could not otherwise do. And so, you know, we'll talk about each of these in a second. But there's a lot of options. You have a lot of options at this point to do things that you couldn't normally do otherwise.
You could even leverage your expertise in the studio into launching a blog called the sixfigurehomestudio.com. And then offering a class called The Profitable Producer to teach people how to run profitable home studios, much like Brian Hood, though he would probably crush you. So you might want to find your own niche.
That goes without saying that there's 3.5 years of blogging for free associated with that before you can do that. There's a lot of, but anyways, I had time to do stuff like that. You don't have time if you're consistently stuck in the niching down phase and or the saying yes to everything phase where you're doing all of the work, you're doing everything. If you don't get to the maximization stage, you can't make it to the pivot stage. So I was able to maximize my studio to the point where I had free time to launch the sixfigurehomestudio.com or to launch my mixing course from Shit to Gold or to launch my real estate business stuff. Like I didn't have time otherwise. And that is the power of stage five of a successful career is being able to pivot into other areas of life and business. And so let's just talk about the list we have right here. You had on our list something called line extension. What the hell is that?
A line extension is we take your brand and you begin offering an additional product or an additional service. So you've gotten to the point where you're like, hey, we're pretty good at this. Let's say we're Crest toothpaste and everyone knows that Crest is great and we've got this on lock. Tell you what, let's start selling some toothbrushes too. I've done this. So
I was about to say, I know you just did this. So I was going to bring that up if you weren't.
Yeah. So niching down, when I began to niche down, I stopped taking anything but mastering projects. A couple years ago, after turning down hundreds and hundreds of mixing projects, I finally said, I'm stupid. I know tons of mix engineers because I'm a mastering engineer. I'm going to hire them and begin offering mixing services as well. And so Chris Graham Mastering also offers mixing services, but it's mix engineers that I've mentored. And it's been going great. It's one of the fastest growing parts of my business, but I don't offer the mixing services. I just oversee them.
Project manager.
Yeah, that line extension was possible because I had done such a great job at elimination, automation, and delegation that I was more efficient at mastering than I ever imagined I could be. And the quality of the work I was doing was better than I ever imagined it could be. So I began to offer additional services, which on its surface, you would look at and say, oh, well, that's not niching down. It is if you do it in the right order.
That's true. Yeah, you got through the first four stages of mastering, and then on stage five, pivot, you were able to do a line extension, offer mixing services.
Absolutely. So that line extension, you can do more than one thing, but you would be wise to focus on mastering one thing, no pun intended, before moving on to that second thing.
So we have line extension, but there's also, if you are just so damn happy about the stage you're at, you have a bunch of extra time and money, and you want to pivot in some way that doesn't really pull you out of audio, you can still invest. You can take that income and you can invest to other areas. So that's one thing I've done is I've taken money from my studio. I've invested in real estate, and that's something that is completely passive on my end, but it is something that does generate income for me. And so that is another area. It could be real estate. That's a little more risky. You can do mutual funds if you want something a little more safe. There's other alternative investments besides that that
gold.
Can bring in revenue. No, get out of here with that shit. Don't even talk about Bitcoin. That's not investing, that's speculating. But you can just continue to pump money into other investment arenas that do bring in up income. So you have this nice floor that you can never go below, or you will rarely go below, that you don't have in your business. Because in your business, if you stop working, you're not getting an income. But if you can properly invest, you have residual income, passive income that you get every single week, every single month, without fail, hopefully. At least a lot less of a fluctuation than you would in the business world.
The next thing you could do, the next pivot you could make, is starting a second business.
Which we talked about. That's what I've done. And I started online education stuff, which is seems to be all the rage. But you have From ShitToGold.com, my mixing course. You have the SixFigureHomeStudio.com, which is, you know, the other stuff I've been doing. But we actually have a lot of examples of guys that have done this. They've gone through all five stages. They've pivoted into a second business. And one of those guys, a lot of you are familiar with, and that's Stephen Slate.
Love him or hate him.
Stephen Slate got his start in audio as a producer or mixing engineer. I don't know a lot about his backstory, to be honest with you. I was not familiar with him until he started Stephen Slate, you know, drum samples, and that grew into plugins. And now Slate Digital is a massive company that has a lot of moving parts, a lot of people working for him. And he's the CEO of Slate Digital, or whatever his parent company is for all the things he does.
He is able to afford to purchase way more leather jackets than he was before he started a second business.
And expensive haircuts. You know, Stephen Slate, none of this, I don't think any of this would have been possible had he not gone through these stages of his career. Now, maybe he didn't go through in the same way with the maximization that we did. Maybe he just cut it out and had savings and could start his business. Or maybe he just did it on the side at nights and weekends. We don't know what his journey looked like up until the point that he launched Stephen Slate Drums.
Maybe we can have him as a guest.
Maybe we'll find out on a podcast episode. Yeah, actually. But he has definitely hit the pivot phase running full force and is making way more at Slate Digital than he ever has, I'm assuming, that he ever has at his in his studio career. So that's one person. We have another person similar to them. That's all the guys at URM, Unstoppable Recording Machine, or Nail the Mix, or whatever. They have a ton of companies. But Joey Sturgis, A.L. Levy, and Joe Wanasek, those three guys, all did this as well. They had their careers, and they got to stage five and pivoted into the other areas. So they have Nail the Mix, which is a education website for mixing heavy music. Nailthemix.com. They have plugins. They all have their own plugins. They have, you know, a whole bunch of other air drum samples, similar to the Stephen Slate thing. And they're doing really, really well.
You know, one of the things to point out with this as well is that it's possible that some of these guys skipped maximization or even skipped niching, that they got into audio and that they eventually found their way to plugin programming, or they eventually found their way to making microphones. You know, that the audio thing turned into a sort of related, but not audio engineering career. And there's no shame in that.
Yeah, and we don't know what they're, like I said, we don't know, everyone's journey is different. We don't know if they went through these phases exactly how we line them up here. This is as close as Chris and I could come to from both of our journeys that we could agree on with these five stages. But without any disagreement, Stephen Slate, Joey Sturgis, Joel Wanasek, all these guys, and the people else we still have to talk about on this list, these all people that have pivoted out of the studio career into something else, into something new, into something that wasn't directly their studio. And that leads us to Graham Cochran. Graham Cochran at therecordingrevolution.com is a perfect example. He's pivoted twice now. He did the studio thing. He pivoted into the audio education. And now he's pivoted out of that into just general business education. And I think he's doing a great job. He's obviously had success with that. And that all started from his home studio.
Yeah. Hats off to him for that. There's an article in Business Insider that came out a bunch of years ago, maybe three or four, about Graham, or he went into his business and it like dropped my jaw when he was like, yeah, I'll do about $70,000 a year, or excuse me, $70,000 a month.
Month, yes. And he used to be on food stamps. His family was on food stamps for a while.
What a story.
That story will be on our show notes on the podcast page.
Yeah, he's great. The next guy, my hero, possibly your hero as well, Barry Gordy.
Yeah, the first six-figure home studio owner.
What a stud. Barry Gordy leveraged his job at a Ford factory into eventually being able to save up enough money and also borrowing money from family to start a small recording studio and then a label and then a talent development company and a publishing company and yada yada. Well, actually, I think the publishing company might have come first. But he was able to leverage and pivot again and again and again and again and again until he had changed the face of modern music and made some money on the way.
Yeah. And our last guy here on our second business list is damn near a billionaire, but he got his career start in audio. Who is this guy?
Jimmy Iovine. If we could pick anyone to interview in the podcast, Jimmy would probably be the guy. Because I don't think anyone's ever been more successful at the things we're talking about than Jimmy Iovine. He engineered a lot of records that you know of. Google the guy, Jimmy Iovine. One of my favorite records. He did one of the really big early Tom Petty records. And he was instrumental as an engineer and a producer. And guy's a stud. He eventually went on to start many businesses, not the least of which was forming a partnership with Dr. Dre to create Beats headphones.
Which you may have heard of.
And
you've heard of Beats by Dre, but you didn't know it was also Beats by Dre and Jimmy Iovine.
Yeah. So Jimmy Iovine probably, when it's all said and done, will have made close to a cool $1 billion.
That's with a B.
With a B on that deal. What a way to leverage your amazing audio ability to launch the... I don't like Beats, you know, full disclosure here, but I respect that he was able to create a business from scratch that nobody was selling over-the-ear headphones like Beats that were stylish and a fashion statement when they came out with them. And they blew up and they sold it to Apple.
Yes.
Woo!
For $3 billion, right? Was that the number?
I don't even know, man. I think it was 1.5.
Whatever. It was a massive number, and hats off to them and everyone else we mentioned in our examples here, because maybe you don't ever pivot. Maybe you just stay in the niching down.
And that's fine.
Just pick your path. But we just kind of laid out the five stages that we thought we could come up with here. And the pivot part, we thought that was a big part of it, because, you know, a lot of times people don't think big enough. They don't think about what is they're capable of doing. And until you see it all laid out for you. And when you see that it's maybe just five stages, that you go from one stage to the next, to the next, to the next, you can kind of identify where you are in these stages and what you need to do to get to where you want to be. And then you realize, holy shit, after I get to my business to the level I want it to be, my studio business, there is more out there to do. There is a lot of fun stuff to do in the business world, in the investment world, into the starting your own second business or whatever that happens to be. There's a lot you can do, and it's a lot of fun. And we just kind of wanted to lay that out there for you.
Yeah. So this was a fun episode. I think, you know, just to echo what Brian was saying, this is a choose your own adventure thing. That ultimately, yep, it shouldn't just be about you becoming this legendary audio engineer. It should be about you becoming happy and building the life that you want. And nobody wants their tombstone to say, you know, a damn good audio engineer, but just not a very happy person. You know, I don't want that in my life.
What a sour man, but he was pretty good at audio.
Yeah.
Pick and choose from this episode what you thought was good and what you just absolutely hated, and just cast aside the stuff you hated and focus on the stuff you liked. And that's pretty much all of our episodes.
Yeah. So here's a quick ask for you guys. The podcast has become, I think I speak for Brian, one of the highlights of our week, getting to record it and getting feedback from you guys. If you would like more of the podcast, if you'd like us to interview more people and hopefully get to a spot where we're interviewing, you know, these really, really, really amazing experienced entrepreneurs, one of the best ways you could do to help us do that is to go on iTunes and write us a review. That 5-star review goes a big way, because if we reach out to Jimmy Iovine and we say, hey, I know you have $1 billion and can do whatever you want, do you want to come on our little wimpy podcast? The first thing he's going to do is going to look at and see how many 5-star reviews there are. So if you want to make an investment in our podcast to continue your education by us finding people who are smarter than we are to teach us all about this stuff, go on iTunes and give us a 5-star review.
You can get there easily by going to the sixfigurehomestudio.com/review. For anyone that has done that already, you are amazing. And anyone that is going to do that, you're also amazing. Anyone that hasn't done that yet, the apathetic person that probably didn't even vote for their president, you are on watch. Whoa.